From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a life in baseball. We talk with Joe Morgan, one of the few second basemen to make it into the Hall of Fame. Morgan, along with Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, and Pete Rose, was part of the lineup during the 1970s that turned the Cincinnati Reds into the Big Red Machine. Also today, from the oil fields of Kuwait to the gold mines of Brazil, we talk with photojournalist Sebastian Salgado about his epic series on manual labor. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews three recordings featuring Polish pianist Christian Zimmerman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has approved $4 billion to extend unemployment benefits for workers whose regular compensation has run out. The measure was the only survivor of President Clinton's job stimulus bill, which was abandoned today by Democratic leaders in the Senate. The Democrats failed again today to break a Republican filibuster that was blocking the job stimulus bill. White House officials and Democratic leaders tried negotiating with the Republicans, but finally gave up. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell asked the Senate to strip all spending from the bill, leaving only the $4 billion for extended jobless benefits. South African police have arrested five more suspects in the assassination of black political leader Chris Hani. Hani was buried Monday after a week of massive protests. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Now holding a total of seven people in connection with the assassination, and a police spokesman today said authorities are still investigating the extent of the alleged conspiracy behind Hani's killing. Those arrested today include a former reporter for a right-wing newspaper and the wife of a prominent Conservative Party politician who was detained earlier. Two British anti-terrorist experts arrived in South Africa today to assist in the Hani investigation. The government agreed to allow foreign oversight of the probe in response to African National Congress demands for an independent investigation. Hani was a top leader in the ANC and the head of the South African Communist Party. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Jury deliberations are now underway in the felony ethics trial of Alabama Governor Guy Hunt. Hunt is charged with using his office for personal gain. Alan Collins of member station WUAL reports.
State prosecutors and defense attorneys quoted from the Bible during closing arguments discussing the fate of Alabama's primitive Baptist governor. Governor Hunt is accused of funneling $200,000 from his 1987 inauguration into his private bank accounts. Alabama Attorney General Jimmy Evans says Governor Hunt sold tickets to his inauguration and put the money into his back pocket. The governor's defense attorney, George Beck, says Governor Hunt is being made a scapegoat. Beck says it's an accepted practice in Alabama politics to convert campaign funds into personal use. The governor has sat quietly during the eight-day trial with his wife, Helen. If Hunt is found guilty, he will be removed from office immediately. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Collins in Montgomery.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 3,439.44. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 286 million shares. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin won a political victory today when Russia's highest court ruled that he needs only a simple majority to win in this weekend's referendum on his powers. The ruling overturned election rules that were set by the Congress of People's Deputies. Those rules, imposed by communist hardliners who still dominate the Congress, would have required Yeltsin to win a majority of all eligible voters, whether they took part in the election or not. 2 days after Italians overwhelmingly voted for radical changes in their electoral system, Prime Minister Giuliano Amato appeared before Parliament this evening to open a debate on the country's political future. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
Contrary to predictions, Giuliano Amato did not tender his resignation today. But in a brief speech, he told Italian deputies that a change of regime is needed. He said that the vote cast by the Italian electorate in the two-day referendum was a sign that it wants to overhaul the entire political framework which has governed Italy for the last 45 years. Amato said that it is now up to the political parties to rebuild their ties with Italian society and to work with its citizens to create a new system based on the autonomy of parliament and not on all-powerful party bosses. Amato had said recently he wanted to resign after a 10-month premiership during which a wave of investigations has revealed decades of political corruption and close links between politicians and organized crime. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Palestinians said today that they'll return to the Middle East peace talks when negotiations resume next week in Washington. The Palestinian delegation had threatened to boycott the talks unless Israel agreed to the immediate return of about 400 Palestinian exiles in South Lebanon. At the same time, though, the Palestinians were under intense pressure from the United States and other Arab participants in the talks who wanted the process to resume after 4 months. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are fewer second basemen in the Baseball Hall of Fame than players in any of the other positions. One of those select few is my guest, Joe Morgan. He was inducted in 1990 after playing 22 years in the majors, mostly with the Houston Astros and the Cincinnati Reds. He was with the Reds in the 70s, along with Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and Tony Perez, when the team was so successful it was known as the Big Red Machine. In 1975 and 76, Morgan was named Most Valuable Player, leading the Reds to the World Series championships both times. After Morgan retired from baseball, he went into business. He now owns a beer distributorship. He also does color casting for ESPN and Giants games. He has a new autobiography called Joe Morgan, A Life in Baseball. I asked Morgan why there are so few second basemen in the Hall of Fame.
A second baseman's main job is to play defense and make the double play. Neither are very glamorous things in baseball because they look for people to hit home runs, drive in runs, do a lot of great things. And normally that doesn't come from your second baseman because they're usually small in frame and small in stature, quick feet. Quickness is their main asset, not power. And therefore, in the past, there have never been second basemen to drive in a lot of runs or to hit home runs. Rogers Hornsby did those things as a second baseman, and he was elected to the Hall of Fame. But most of your second basemen in the past, Charlie Gehringer, Bobby Doerr, had a little power, and I added something to that. I hit more home runs, I guess, than any second baseman's ever played that position. So that made me a candidate for the Hall of Fame. But the real reason is because their main jobs are defense, and they're not known for their offensive numbers.
What did you like and not like about playing that position?
You know, I can't think of anything I didn't like. I was very proud to have been a second baseman in that I think it takes a special type of person to play second base. The rules have changed a little bit now, but when I first came into the league and when I played, there were no rules governing how a guy could come in and knock you over. And I always felt it was a really kind of a test of your character and manhood to be able to stand there with your back to the runner, knowing that he's going to try to break you in half, and your first thoughts had to be make the double play first and then worry about my body. And very few people can do that and do it well, and that's why I was always proud to be a second baseman. And really, there were no negatives as far as I'm concerned for me as a second baseman. I just loved the position.
What were your worst moments of impact?
I had a few. One, 1969, I was stretched out to receive a throw, and Tommy Agee from the Mets hit me with a cross body block, which is a football block. As I said, there were no rules then, and tore up my knee like a football. I had a football injury. I had O'Donohue's triad, which is the worst you can have, worst knee injury you can have. It's collateral ligament, cartilage, and just a lot of damage to your knee. And they never figured I would be able to play second base again.
You were considered one of the most complete players in the game because you had a great hitting record, stolen bases, great at second base. I mean, a real all-around player. You got Most Valuable Player twice. Is that something that you consciously tried to develop, to be an all-around player?
Yes, it was. I did not go out to be the best, but I wanted to be the most complete player in the game. And I think I reached that goal in, you know, 75, 76 in that era. Growing up in California, my father would take me to the minor league games, the Oakland Oaks. We would see the players, and my father would say, well, he's a good player. He can hit, but he doesn't feel very well. He can feel, but he doesn't hit. And my father always impressed upon me to try to be a complete player. So I think I worked harder on my defense than I did any other part of the game. Everyone loves to hit, and usually that's where they channel their energies. With me, I channel my energies toward my weaknesses. If I was a good hitter, which I was all during my minor league career, but I was not as good defensively. So I worked very hard on my defense. Then I worked very hard on my stolen bases. I did everything to make myself a complete player. I set one year when my knee was torn up, I sat behind home plate every single game and charted things about how a pitcher delivers the ball to the plate, how a catcher sets up for a pitch out, how everything happens defensively to stop you from stealing a base. So that made me a much better base stealer because I knew everything that they could do by the time I got back on the field. And so that helped me to be a complete player. I used to work out every day from 3 o'clock till 5, making double plays, and then go play a game. I sacrificed some of my statistics that year because I was tired by the time the game started. But I had a goal in mind, and I reached that goal at the end of that season when I thought I was a complete player, and I was a good defensive player by that time. So I had to work hardest on my defense, and I was probably most proud of my defensive accomplishments.
Let's talk about your height. You're one of the comparatively shorter players from baseball, 5'7", I think. When you first got to the majors, and, you know, you were a rookie, and pitchers are always trying to take advantage of rookies. Was it worse for you because you were short?
I think it was a little bit because they knew I wasn't going to charge the mound. You know, I was a small guy, and they were afraid of me. And they felt, you know, probably they take liberties with you. But as a rookie, when I came along, they tested every rookie. Didn't matter because they had Leo DeRocher, Gene Mauch. These type of individuals were managers, and they always wanted to test rookies. And I remember my first game against Philadelphia. Chris Short was pitching, and opening day, it was my first game in the big leagues, and I went 3-for-4, you know, first opening day game. I went 3-for-4. We played them like 3 days later. The next day I came up to bat first inning. They started knocking me down, you know, throwing the ball behind my neck and all that. And as a rookie, you better not say anything. Well, you're better off not saying anything. Some people make waves, but I don't think it helps them. Me, I just took it and as part of the game, and it's something I had to prove to my not only my teammates, but to the league that Joe Morgan was here to stay, and he was going to do whatever he had to do to get to the end of his goals.
Well, real psychological warfare, huh?
Oh, yeah. In professional sports, I think that's one thing that people really can't comprehend is that there's so much intimidation that goes on. See, when you get to the top of your profession, your skills are similar. Not always the same, but similar. So if you can get an edge by having a guy afraid of you while he's standing in the batter's box, obviously that makes your skills better than his because he's afraid to use his. And that's part of the game. As a second baseman, intimidation, they wanted to knock you around because they figured next time you'd get out of the way instead of trying to make the double play. So intimidation is a very big part of all sports. I mean, in football, it's even more so probably, and basketball, all your professional sports.
In your book, you write that your first game in the Astrodome, that you were worried about being a little guy in a cavernous stadium, but then you realized that you were a player of the future. You were ideally suited to these new parks. What made you feel ideally suited to them?
When I first started, and I remember they wanted all big guys because they wanted them to hit home runs. All right, with the Astrodome, there were like four other new stadiums being built at the same time. And in the new stadium, they were going to house football and baseball. So the stadiums were becoming larger. And what happens in large stadiums is that now all of a sudden, the home run hitter is not as productive as he was in a smaller stadium. So you have to look to other ways of scoring runs. And the other ways were speed, and obviously you need defense in a bigger ballpark. And you just need to have a sense of how to play the game. I think it's a smarter game in the larger ballparks than it was in the smaller ballparks. And the Astrodome was the first of the large ballparks. And it was also the first ballpark with AstroTurf. AstroTurf puts a premium on speed and quickness rather than power and home run hitters. So I knew that I could make myself a player of the future by learning to steal bases, by playing better defense, positioning myself better, knowing more about how to play bigger ballparks. And again, I did all of that, and I think that's the reason that I'm in the Hall of Fame, because of that year spent of really learning what the modern player was going to have to embody.
Joe Morgan is my guest. Baseball Hall of Famer has written a new autobiography called Joe Morgan, A Life in Baseball. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about baseball with Joe Morgan. Now, you grew up near the old Oakland Park.
Yes.
Did you go there? Were you in walking distance? Could you just walk over there?
Walked over. It was a great. I had a great childhood. My parents always made sure that I was able to enjoy the fruits of being a child. You know, I didn't have to mature too quickly. I was not expected to know everything at the age of 10 or 12. I could be a kid and enjoy, you know, just enjoy life. I lived about, I'd say, maybe 8 to 10 blocks. You know, everything looks bigger when you're a little kid, you know. So it may have been a little less. But we walked to the stadium, to Oaks Ballpark. Oakland Oaks were the team, the home team in the Pacific Coast League. And my father and my oldest sister, Linda, I'm the oldest, but she was next to me. We would walk up, we'd eat dinner every night at home, walk up to the stadium, watch the game, come back home. I mean, it was like, you know, as a kid, like I said, that's the greatest thing could happen to you, to be able to go to the ballpark with your father every day that the team is in town and to enjoy it and learn about the game and be able to watch future major leaguers and great players that you want to emulate as you grow older. And so I was able to go to the game every day, and it was really a great experience that I will always treasure.
So your father must have been a big baseball fan, too.
Oh, yes. My father he still is, and my father was a big sports fan. We would go to the San Francisco 49er games. My father would take me each Sunday.
Couldn't walk there.
No, couldn't walk there. But my father was a baseball player. He played, you know, but it was before the color line was broken, and my father, and I had like three or four uncles. Two of them they think were good enough to make it to the major leagues, but again, in those days, and they grew up in a small town, and it was Mount Bonham, Texas, which is, you know, not where you're going to find all your major league scouts watching anyway, but even in those days, you know, blacks were not able to play in major leagues.
So did he play in the black leagues?
Yes, he did. He wanted, but not the major league black leagues. He played in, what they did was, we were in Bonham, Texas. There's 20 little cities around there, and they had leagues, you know, Negro leagues, and they play it there, you know, they have schedules, and they would play. And I was kind of the bat boy at the beginning for my father's team.
Gee, so your father probably had not only a sense of baseball, but a sense of race in baseball.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My father, as I try to say in the book, I think the one thing, I'm not a typical person because I didn't grow up in a poverty situation. I didn't grow up in the ghetto, so to speak. My father, but it wasn't because we were rich. It was because my father worked very hard. My father worked two jobs, so to speak, a lot of his life so that I could have everything I wanted. I mean, when it was time for me to get a bicycle, I said, I want a bike. I'd go down and get a bike. When it was time for me, I want a race car, whatever, my father would take me to get it. And I always thought, hey, well, you know, we must have a lot of money, you know, because we were always able to do that. And my father, I had a dollar a day for school, and it was like it cost 25 cents for lunch, right? So, I mean, you know, I had all this money. And all the other kids thought my father was rich and whatever. And I didn't realize any differently as a kid. I didn't realize except I know my father would go up in the middle of the night and go to work again, you know. And you think in terms of, well, he's going to work. But I didn't realize, you know, as a kid that you're only supposed to work 8 hours a day, you know. But he was going to work all the time. But we always, when we needed something or wanted something, it was there, you know. And so I didn't grow up in a poverty situation. I didn't grow up where maybe my childhood would have had me distrusting other people or not liking certain people. I didn't have that environment as a kid.
When you were scouted and you got into the minors, you were in the Carolina League first. You were playing in the segregated South. And you write about how you were so absorbed in baseball. It took you a while to actually realize what segregation meant, what it meant in your life then. So what were some of the things you were up against that bothered you most during those days in the minors?
Well, when I first started playing professional baseball, well, I grew up in California. You know, as the old cliche goes, some of my best friends were white, some of my best friends were blue, green, whatever. I mean, I just had friends, and I didn't think in those terms, and they didn't think that way either. So I went to Durham, and then we went on our first road trip, I guess about a week after I'd been there, or maybe 10 days. And so we're going to Winston-Salem, and we're on a bus, we drive to Winston-Salem, we go to downtown hotel, and everyone starts to get off. So I start to get off, and the bus driver, who was black, says, hey, wait a minute, you don't get off here. I said, what do you mean? I'm, you know, for my team. He said, no, we stay in a different section of town. And, man, now that's like, you know, what do you mean? I'm part of this team. No, you're over there. So I sit back down. We go over to the black community, and we stayed there. Accommodations weren't as nice. Didn't have any air conditioning, but the food was great. So I had a great time as far as that. And that night, you know, we're separate rooms. He said, "Let's go. It's time to go to the stadium." So we get in the bus. Now we go back to pick up all my teammates at the hotel downtown. We pick them up and we go to the stadium, and we all get dressed. And I walked out, and all of a sudden, everything kind of became very clear, and it was like a slap in the face. It really woke me up. I see a sign that says colored drinking fountain. Then I see one that says white drinking fountain. I go a few steps further, says white restrooms, and then it says black. I mean, it said colored in those days. And now that I thought that was bad, right? So then I walk around the fence to go into outside the playing field. And when I walked around to enter the field, the fans, there were a lot of fans in the right field stands, and they started yelling, you know, clapping. And I looked over, and there were a lot of black people there. And they were clapping because they didn't see, there weren't any black people on the Durham team in the past, you know, and here I was there. So they started clapping, and I looked over, and I got very upset because there was a screen there, and it looked like they were in a cage. You know, it was, and you know, again, this is my perception of what I saw. You know, maybe it didn't feel that way to them. Maybe it didn't look that way to other people, but it looked that way to me. It looked like they were in a cage, and that disturbed me quite a bit. And I felt like that I was helping this image to continue. By playing in front of, you know, playing this game, I was as guilty as everyone else. I was part of this, you know, thing that was really, to me, just downgrading to black people. And I said that I was going to leave. I said, I can't, you know, play and be a part of this. So I left, and I went and actually called and made reservations to go home. And then I played the game. My reservations were to leave the next morning.
You were going to leave
California.
The whole league?
I was going
to
leave. I said, you know, I have more respect for my people in this than to be a part of this, and to be a part of continuing to you know, degrade the situation. Just being a part, playing there to me was part of, I was a part of it. So I was going to leave. And after the game, I went back, packed my bags, and I was leaving the next morning. And the bus driver, of course, tried to talk me out of it, and I said, no, it's just something I have to do. And I guess, you know, as I say in the book, it was nothing like thinking about what Jackie Robinson had to go through or other minorities had to go through to help make the country great. The only thing that kept me there was having to face my father and tell him that I quit. And so I decided to stay, but I don't think I ever got over, and I don't think I ever will get over the feeling I had the first day I walked around there and I saw all those people. It was very devastating for me.
Joe Morgan is my guest, Baseball Hall of Famer, author of a new autobiography. There's a fan question I want to ask mm-hmm. you. You were there the day, it was the Reds and the Mets World Series. Mets won, fans went crazy, destroyed the field, tore apart the stadium. What did that look like from your perspective?
It was very frightening.
I can imagine.
It was frightening for two reasons. You know, how am I going to defend myself against fans who are really idolize what we do on the field, but they're just overzealous at this particular time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I remember specifically Johnny Bench, myself, we grabbed bats because our families were right above the dugout, and they were tearing this dugout down, and our family had been forced to come into the dugout on the field. Now we're standing guard there with bats, but it's frightening to think that, am I going to hit some of these people, you know, with this baseball bat? And I guess in my mind, to answer you today, the answer would have been yes, because my wife was standing behind me. And I'm not going to let these people hurt my family just because they're overzealous. But, I mean, it was going to be very difficult for me to hit somebody with a baseball bat. But, I mean, I was at the point where I would have done that because they were just so unruly. I mean, it was like a mob. And you remember, you know, there's 50,000 people there and probably 10 to 20,000 over our dugout that were doing this. And it was so frightening that – you know, none of us really knew what to do. We were standing there kind of, you know, petrified, because I guess the best thing for us to do would have been to run into the clubhouse. But then where there's no assurance that they wouldn't have followed us. So I guess we just chose to make our stand right there at the dugout.
So what was it like in 1990 when you were inducted into the Hall of Fame?
You know, it's something that I've tried to describe in the book, but I don't think that I could ever do justice to it, because I'm not a poet. I'm not someone who can, you know, have great things to say with their words and their feelings. I really, it was like this most special moment you can have, you know, as far as I'm concerned. As a baseball player, I'd won, you know, the Most Valuable Player Award. I've won world championships. And I thought nothing could top that. I thought, hey, this is like, I mean, the way I felt after our first world championship was like, I had this feeling that I was like in space or someplace. I'm like just floating around. There's nothing. There's no other pressures. There's no other problems in the world. And I felt perfect, you know, that for that first 20 minutes after we won the world championship. And when I went to the Hall of Fame for the induction, it started slowly, because I had never been to the Hall of Fame before. I'd never been up there to the Cooperstown. I went a day early. I got a private tour of the Hall of Fame. And I guess it started to build up then. When you walk into a place and it's like a mausoleum, it's so quiet. It's like unbelievable. And you walk in and there are plaques with images of Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron, you know, Ty Cobb, all the greatest players who've ever lived. And then they show you the spot where yours is going. You know, they're going to have a picture of Joe Morgan there. And, you know, it just starts to build up to know that 100 years from now, you know, whoever walks into the Hall of Fame will know that Joe Morgan was here. They may not know who I was or care, but they will know that I was somebody special because I played baseball. And I have two daughters that are 2 years old. And one of these days they'll bring their kids there and be able to see that. So that was probably the most emotional day, as I am now, for me, you know, in my life. It really was. And to stand there, I guess, with all the greatest players in the world behind you, who've ever lived, like Ted Williams, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, and to have to talk about Joe Morgan was very difficult, because in my own mind, you know, I will never, I guess, be able to compare myself to Willie Mays or Stan Musial or Mickey Mantle, because to me, that's when I was a kid. Growing up, these people were like not real. They were superhuman people, and that's still a problem for me. It really is, and I think of myself as being, you know, I say that they left big, big footprints, and I only left a small one. But however small, when you go to the Hall of Fame, I'm sitting right next to them.
Joe Morgan, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Joe Morgan has a new autobiography called Joe Morgan, A Life in Baseball. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photojournalist Sebastian Salgado looks at the grimy world of backbreaking manual labor and turns it into a thing of strange beauty. Since 1987, he's traveled around the world taking pictures of workers in coal mines, gold mines, sugarcane fields, ships, and factories to document what he suspects is the end of an era. Coming up, Salgado tells us about photographing firefighters in the burning oil fields of Kuwait after the war. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews three recordings by Polish pianist Christian Zimmermann of music by Beethoven, Schubert, and Polish composer Witold Lutosławski. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Democrats have given up on their efforts to get President Clinton's jobs bill through the Senate. Republican opposition to the bill has given the White House its first major legislative setback. After hours of negotiations, the Senate approved $4 billion the bill contained for jobless benefits and stripped the rest of the money from the measure. The tally was taken by voice vote. Democratic Senator Robert Byrd charged that while the other side was congratulating itself on proving it's a force to be reckoned with, the Republicans have only proved they're the guardians of gridlock. Meanwhile, the White House is considering a tax on health benefits. The money would be used to offer health insurance to everyone. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The White House Task Force on Health Reform estimated in January that giving health insurance to people who don't have it now will cost $30 to $90 billion a year. Task Force Chief Hillary Rodham Clinton met this week with the Senate Finance Committee to discuss ways to raise those funds. According to Capitol Hill sources, she told the senators that the administration plans to call for a tax on health care benefits. One idea is to tax any benefits that exceed what the government says is a basic plan. That would mean you or your employer might pay a tax on insurance that provides for a private room during hospitalization, for example. People who advocate a tax say that it would do more than just raise money. It would also make consumers more cost-conscious and keep them from overusing the medical system. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Arab leaders have agreed to resume peace talks with the Israelis in Washington April 27th, ending a four-month suspension caused by Israel's deportation of some 400 Palestinians last December. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who has worked hard to revive the peace talks, praised Palestinian leaders for agreeing to return to the table, even though the deportees have not yet been repatriated and the Israeli government has not ruled out future deportations.
We realize that the decision to rejoin the talks was a difficult one for them to make. I think it was a courageous one, and I commend them for making it.
Key Arab leaders who are eager to resume negotiations with Israel pressured the Palestinian delegation to return. In addition, Saudi Arabia announced it would resume funding for the Palestine Liberation Organization. But many Palestinians will be unhappy with the decision to resume talks. A spokesman for the deportees called it a cheap sellout. But Secretary Christopher said only negotiations can produce real peace and security for the Palestinians, other Arabs, and Israel. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 4 points to close at 3,439.44 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. After a week and a half, a standoff at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility is ending. Some 450 prison inmates have been holding five guards hostage and are now surrendering. Some inmates are being escorted out of their cell block, and some are carried out on stretchers. In exchange for a peaceful surrender, state officials promised to review the inmates' complaints, including religious objections to tuberculosis testing and a federal law that requires integration of prison cells. The Clinton administration has proposed national standards for schools and occupational standards for business and industry. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Bill Clinton's education plan calls for government-sanctioned academic standards in math, science, English, history, and geography. They're voluntary, but they're the first ever proposed by the federal government. A national commission would be created to monitor schools' progress towards these standards. The best state and local efforts would be rewarded with cash. The president is asking Congress for $393 million to create that fund. The president also wants to create a national workforce council made up of business, labor, and education groups. groups that would set new occupational skills standards. The council would issue a certificate of mastery that would be valued by trade groups and employers across the country. High school graduates would be able to take an added year of schooling and training to help them meet these new workplace standards. Education Secretary Richard Riley strongly denied that the push for standards would lead to national tests or a national curriculum for schools. The bill now goes to the Congress for a vote. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The Red Cross has started a worldwide campaign against landmines. According to the Geneva-based organization, some 800 people are killed every month by mines, many of them women and children. Officials say that one person in every 236 in Cambodia has needed an amputation because of mine injuries. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Photojournalist Sebastian Salgado spent 5 years traveling around the world, taking pictures of men and women who make their living doing backbreaking manual labor. He photographed in gold mines, coal mines, oil fields, sugarcane fields, ships, and factories. His new book, Workers, has just been published. An exhibition of those photos just opened at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Art critic Edward Sazansky described it as an epic production that includes some of the most powerful and occasionally astonishing images that any photographer has produced. Salgado has received just about all the photojournalism awards you can get. He's Brazilian-born, and although he now lives in Paris, he's done much of his work in the Third World. Salgado's first career was as an economist. He never earned his living by doing backbreaking work. I asked what interests him in the people who do.
I believe that all things that you have here inside this studio is made in a factory, is made by a group of people that today we forget they exist, is working class. But we forget a little bit about this working class. And we mind only about the services sector. And for me, when I went to photograph this, was to give a homage to this working class that for me was very, very important.
For me, the most amazing photographs in the work series are of the photographs of the gold mine in Brazil. And several people have compared these photographs to epic movies, like Cecil B. DeMille movies. I have to say, to me, it almost looks like the slave labor scenes of the Ten Commandments, where there's thousands and thousands of people. Would you visually describe what that mine looks like?
I tell you, the first day that I arrived to photograph this mine, when I arrived in the border of this mine, because it was not too big, it was about the size of a football stadium, or a little bit bigger than this, and I saw down about 50,000 persons work. To do this picture was necessary to go down in these stairs with the workers, to go in the same place of the workers were, to this place with them, to live inside. I spent there about 3 weeks, and I went in place inside this mine. I took many different shots in many different points, but I was way displaced more or less with the workers.
What did it sound like in the mine?
We had just human sounds. 50,000 persons speaking between them, working, and that's in a hole. And when you arrive in the border of this, you hear all the sound come up. And just some metallic instruments hitting the land, sometimes hitting a stone, and all this inside. For me, I made these pictures. I'm photograph probably end of a era because many things are changing these pictures. But it would be incredible to register the sound of end of a year because many of the sounds will disappear.
You have a series of photographs of the men putting out the oil fires in Kuwait after the Gulf War. The men who you photographed are completely covered in oil, and it almost makes them look like statues because they almost look bronzed. Did they look almost unhuman to you while you were taking the pictures?
Oh, no. The sun was covered by oil. Some days was not possible to see the sun. The whole earth was covered by oil. The smoke and air were burning. The planet was burning this month. And you have these people fighting very hard with bigger risk for their life because you have many of these works that were burning. They're killed, burning, working on this. In this month, work closing for them, they were the most human persons that I never met because they are saving the planet for us in some way.
What effect did it have on your cameras and your film to take pictures in an atmosphere that was filled with smoke from the oil fires?
Well, the films ended. The films reacted very well, no problem. But the cameras, I lose some cameras there because I was completely covered by oil too sometimes. And my cameras get so many oil that to clean them, to clean the lens, was necessary to clean with petrol. And I have inside my photo bag 2 liters of petrol that was always cleaning cameras, cleaning lens, cleaning hand, cleaning the face. And a lot of this petrol went inside the cameras. And after this, the cameras were not more good. And 1 or 2 lens, they were deformed by the heat, by the fire. It was very close to photograph, and I have some deformation on them. But after Kuwait, it was necessary to me to change my cameras.
Were you frightened?
Sometimes were very special because we always work alone. This place for one group working to the other. It was necessary to cross very close of this huge fires. The sound of very, very big. And lakes of oil. And sometimes when I'm working there, we had cars cross inside these lakes that ignite the oil. And they burn the cars, they burn the people. We had a photographer that were working together in a day from Financial Times from London. With the journalists, they were crossing inside one of these lakes and the car ignited the fire and they was burning inside. It's just a small risk that you take there. And we had, middle of all this, a lot of tanks that were destroyed. I met some soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, that were killed in the middle of these fields and they were abandoned, the bodies there. They were completely mummified by the oil. And was a little bit a vision of the hell some moments. You know, some moments were very special, this. A lot of weapons abandoned anywhere. And it was very special, very, very special, this.
Do you still have the smell of the oil in your nose?
That I have.
What is the smell in your nose?
The smell is a very, very heavy, special smell. It's the smell of gas anywhere. And smoke, oil burn, and the oil don't burn completely. Some part burn, some don't burn. And you have this smell, you have the heat, and you have the rain of the oil. Same if you are not close of a well that's threw out a lot of oil. After the fire, you have a lot of this rain of oil that come over you with the smell. It was very special. It's, if I must make the definition of the smell of the hell, probably this.
When you say something is very special, how do you mean that? Usually when you say something special, it means it's very good. Is that what you mean?
Something special, no, that means that it's very good. For us, the North, come from different culture, in Brazil, something special, that means something that you never lived before.
Mm-hmm.
Something very, very different for any others. That means that's not good, that's not bad. It's special.
Okay, like unique.
Yes, yeah. Absolute. It's unique is the word.
My guest is photojournalist Sebastian Salgado. We're after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photojournalist Sebastian Salgado. His new exhibition and book feature his pictures of workers. You told me right before we started our interview that you've lost most of your hearing in one ear, and there's some frequencies that you can't hear in your other ear. Is that because all of the noise that you've been exposed to making
big
pictures?
Big part of this lose was made in Kuwait, and because I had not, I forget to bring the things to protect my ears. And sometimes when they gave 1 or 2, put inside and take out a lot of oil, come inside this and bring it to put a lot of oil inside your ears. And the end I was not working with this, and it was a shame. Because now for me to hear, sometimes a little bit difficult. And that most of this come from there.
So this was from Kuwait?
Yes, big part was from Kuwait.
Were you very upset when you realized what had happened?
No. That's that's my profession, that's my work, that's a, say, it's a professional disease. It's okay, it's like it is. I chose to be there, and if it was necessary to go there again, I will. Because for me it was, like you say, a unique experience. And very few persons had this experience in their life.
You grew up in Brazil.
Yes.
You were born there in 1944. You were trained as an economist.
Yes.
What kind of future did you see for yourself when you were studying economics? What did you think you were going to become?
Well, you know, it's quite different to be a student of economics in one country like Brazil and probably like here, because it was so necessary to have economists in Brazil. And like is until now, because the economic crisis is so huge, so big, social crisis is very big. And the kind of economy that when I came inside the school in Brazil, we were doing was macroeconomics, is to see the way to create big projects for employment, to see how it was possible to get incentive for some kind of industry, place of the others, and create jobs, to create a new possibility to work, to live the better social life for the persons. But in a moment, I discovered photography and I changed my life. I begin to do pictures. But in reality, I don't change many things. My pictures are about the same, like my studies in economy and the work that I did in economy. García Márquez tells one very interesting thing. He tells that any writer write new books, he always write a new version of the same book. That means in the life you do about the same things always.
When you were coming of age, when you were growing up, was Brazil under military rule?
Well, no, when I was growing up, Brazil were not. In 1964, when I had 20 years, Brazil came inside a huge military rule that stay in the country until, in a very hard way, for 15 years, until 1979, when they gave a political amnesty. And this time, I came inside the college, and in this time, a big resistance for this military rule came out, mainly for the students, for the workers.
You left Brazil in 1969. Why did you leave?
I lived because my militants, my relations with the leftist groups that were contesting this military rule, and I had many of my friends that were with me, that were arrested, that were tortured, that were killed. And in this moment, the best idea was or to go completely to the clandestinity and go to the weapon in the hands and fight real. That was real, not very possible in this time because the situation was not real for this. Or to go out of Brazil. And I went with my wife out of Brazil. And in 1979, they gave a political amnesty. And we came back of 11 years, 10 and a half years out of Argo.
When you moved to France in 1969, you were still an economist. And then you studied at the university in Paris.
Yes.
And then you continued to do economic work. What was the turning point for you, from when you changed from economist to photographer?
You know, I was studying in Paris. I was doing the theories of a PhD, the theoretical studies for a PhD in economics. And my wife was doing studies of architecture. She's an architect. And she bought a camera to make pictures of architecture. And I discovered photography in this moment. My first pictures was 1970, when I look inside this camera. And I begin to see the possibility to have a different relation with the person that I was living with. And I begin to take some pictures. A few months later, I had a dark room, different lens, and photography made a real invasion of my life. Just 1971, I went to London to work in an international coffee organization, like economist. And I had the opportunity to make many different trips to Africa, because we are working in economic development projects, made investment for diversification of the coffee plantations in Africa. And I bring this camera with me. And the cameras gave 10 times more pleasure than the economic report that was necessary to write when I came back to London. In 1973, I get the decision to put all beside, come back to Paris, begin my life of a reporter, because in France you have all these big agents of photography, and I begin my life of photographer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Photojournalist Sebastian Salgado. His exhibition, Workers, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. His book, Workers, is published by Aperture. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we are watching the situation in Lucasville, Ohio. We'll also have some reports on Waco, one from the Justice Department. Some people who've been thinking a lot about cults, about how to prevent confrontations with cults and cult leaders, and what the notions of responsibility, who is responsible for the people who are inside a group like that. Wendy Kaufman has an interview with one of the jurors in the LAPD trial in Los Angeles. Robert Siegel and a Holocaust historian went on a tour of the new Holocaust Museum in Washington, and the Congress is still chewing on the president's stimulus package.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Polish pianist Christian Zimmerman is just winding up his latest American tour. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Zimmerman is in a direct line of great Polish pianists, beginning with Chopin. Like his compatriot Artur Rubinstein, Zimmerman is primarily associated with romantic music. But Lloyd says the greatest impression Zimmerman has made so far may be in a piece of contemporary music that was composed for him.
He's so good. Why isn't he more famous? That's what an executive at Deutsche Grammophon asked recently about one of their own artists, Christian Zimmerman. It's a good question. Zimmerman has an impeccable and powerful technique, a warm, rich, clear tone, and a poetic soul. But he's also something of a maverick with standards. In 1979, at the age of 23, at the height of his career, Zimmerman canceled all his concert appearances and took a year off to study music and languages. A few years later, he became dissatisfied with the quality of his recordings. He stopped making records for 6 years and began an extensive study of acoustics and sound engineering. In 1987, the great Polish composer Witold Lutosławski wrote his only piano concerto for him. Zimmerman's recent recording, conducted by the composer, has just won the Edison Award, the Dutch Music Award that's a lot more prestigious than a Grammy. The concerto is an exhilarating, sometimes magical, and very musical work that takes full advantage of Zimmerman's power and his extraordinary delicacy. Zimmerman's newest release is a set of live performances of the 5 Beethoven piano concertos. This began as a joint project with Leonard Bernstein, who conducted the last 3 concertos. Here's Zimmerman and Bernstein in the Emperor Concerto. When Bernstein died, Zimmerman refused to record the first two concertos with another conductor, so he ended up leading them himself from the piano. Another of Zimmerman's recent recordings is his exquisite version of Schubert's 8 impromptus. These familiar pieces are short but substantial. The longest is nearly 12 minutes. It was probably Schubert's publisher who labeled the first group of four impromptus. Schubert must have liked the suggestion of spontaneity and improvisation because he then gave the same name to the next four. These pieces range from the most poignant intimacy to an almost military heroism, sometimes both within the same piece. As always, Zimmerman's dazzling technique is at the service of his vivid imagination.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed recent recordings by pianist Christian Zimmerman. Zimmerman concludes his American tour with concerts at Carnegie Hall this Friday night and Boston Symphony Hall Sunday afternoon. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's Earth Day, and we talk about the conservation of African wildlife. Journalist Ray Bonner tells us why living in Africa for 4 years challenged everything he used to believe about the wildlife conservation movement. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.